From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Edwin Scholes and Tim Lehman have witnessed the elaborate and unusually choreographed mating dances of birds of paradise, which truly defy description. The moves, the calls, the plumage show how creative and outlandish evolution can be. Scholes and Lehman documented their adventures and discoveries in videos and in a book. A new exhibit of their work opens this weekend at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University in Philadelphia. Edwin Scholes is an evolutionary biologist. Tim Lehman is a wildlife photo journalist and field biologist, and they join us on Radio Times to talk about finding 39 species of birds of paradise. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
Significantly to 6.3%. About 288,000 new jobs were also created. Scott Brown is chief economist at Raymond James & Associates.
If you just look at the headline numbers, this is a monster report. But if you go through the details and consider the weather rebound, seasonal adjustment issues, you know, we remember the payroll numbers are only reported accurate to 90,000. The unemployment rate's only reported accurate to plus or minus 0.2%. So all of that suggests, you know, it's encouraging, but, you know, we want to see another couple months of this.
The drop in the unemployment rate also occurred because fewer people were entering the labor force in April. The interim government of Ukraine has opened a military offensive to force pro-Russian separatists out of government buildings. But the separatists have launched a military response today. They've shot down two Ukrainian attack helicopters, killing at least two people. Fighting broke out around the city of Slavyansk. Ukrainian officials say the separatists are using sophisticated weapons that must be from Russia. Russia says Ukraine has destroyed any hope for peace in the region. European Union officials are worried about the escalating tension. Terry Schultz reports from Brussels. EU officials are calling on Russia to make more effort to de-escalate the crisis.
With the situation deteriorating rapidly in eastern Ukraine, EU spokeswoman Maya Kochianchyk says officials in Brussels are watching with growing concern. She says pro-Russian militants must stop what she calls illegal actions.
Occupied buildings need to be vacated. All persons illegally detained need to be released.
Kochianchyk mentions in particular concern about a team of European military monitors seized last Friday by separatists in Slavyansk. She says the EU is looking to Moscow to back these calls, but the Kremlin has responded to such concerns by saying it's Western support for the interim government in Kiev that's preventing de-escalation of the crisis. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
In Syria, dozens of civilians have died at the hands of Syrian government forces and of rebels. NPR's Alice Fordham reports on fresh attacks across the country.
Two car bombs exploded in small towns outside the central city of Hama. State media reported the attacks killed 18 civilians, including 11 children. And in the wake of a broken deal between regime and rebel forces, airstrikes hit a market in an opposition-held area of Aleppo Thursday evening. Activists said five militants were killed, but 38 civilians died too, including children. Meanwhile, in Damascus, plans for a presidential election are progressing. State media says there are now 24 candidates for the June poll. Alice Fordham, NPR News, Beirut.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 35 points at 16,596. The Nasdaq is up 2 points at 41.29. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Good morning. It's 10:04. I'm Jennifer Lynn with WHYY News. All four Democrats running for Pennsylvania governor say they want to dissolve the School Reform Commission, which governs public schools in Philadelphia. WHYY's Kevin McCory reports they outlined different ideas for replacing the SRC at a debate on education issues this week.
The SRC was created in 2001 with the intention that the state would have more of a say in and take more responsibility for the outcomes achieved in Philadelphia public schools. The governor nominates three commissioners, the mayor nominates two. Nearly 13 years later, there's a growing sentiment in the city that state intervention hasn't made things better.
I think the School Reform Commission has not worked.
That's Democratic gubernatorial candidate and current Pennsylvania treasurer Rob McCord.
Very importantly, we don't know who to hold accountable. We don't know whether or not to hold the mayor accountable, the governor accountable.
McCord wouldn't commit to exactly how the new school board should be elected or appointed. Katie McGinty, former Pennsylvania Environmental Protection Secretary, said she'd set up a commission to study the best way to fill a school board.
For me, this is really about getting back to what we know works, and that is neighborhood schools, and it is local ownership of those schools.
Tom Wolf is the York County businessman currently leading the Democratic field.
Every other school district in Pennsylvania is governed by an independently elected school board for whom education is the number one priority. So my preference would be to go to an elected school board.
Congresswoman Allison Schwartz reminded the audience that she's been against the SRC since its inception.
I actually voted against the SRC. I was Democratic chair of the Education Committee for 10 years in the state Senate.
Like all the Democrats, Schwartz stressed that 86ing the SRC wouldn't take the state off the hook financially.
The state constitution says the state has the responsibility to fair fund our schools and educate every child in the state. It is not an option.
If one of these Democrats is elected in the fall and follows through on this campaign pledge, the matter would still have to go through the Republican-controlled state legislature. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
It's 10:06. You're listening to WHYY-FM.
I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. The bright and wildly designed plumage, elaborate courtship rituals, and unusual mating calls of birds of paradise show just how creative evolution can be. Edwin Scholes and Tim Lehman have spent nearly a decade and thousands of hours in the remote rainforests of New Guinea and along the northeast coast of Australia, documenting the diversity and extraordinary mating dances of 39 species of this bird. They have called it Survival of the Sexiest. An exhibit of their discoveries, Birds of Paradise, Amazing Avian Evolution, is on view at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University here in Philadelphia from May 3rd to September 1st. We were so blown away by the appearance and behavior of these birds and what it took to find them and document them that we invited Scholes and Lehman to join us on Radio Times. Edwin Scholes is an evolutionary biologist, also curator of video at the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And Edwin Scholes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Tim Lehman. He's an award-winning wildlife photojournalist and field biologist. And Tim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. And I'm so blown away by these birds, I have to say. And they are such a reminder that all species really are about reproduction and survival. But they have taken this to such an extreme. Why is that?
That's a unique combination of things. Birds of paradise are only found in this one part of the world, so they're largely centered around New Guinea and Australia. And so one of the key things here is just like Australia has a pretty unique fauna, it doesn't have a lot of the placental mammals that you find in other parts of Asia and around the world. That means there aren't some certain kinds of predators that would potentially interfere with this being such an extreme form of evolution in other parts of the world. And also there's a less competition for the resources like the fruit and things that birds of paradise eat. New Guinea's kind of a paradise for birds, so there's a lot of fruit available. So two things combined has really allowed evolution to become very extreme through this one unique type of mating system that is common to birds of paradise and other things as well, but it's where you have this really strong reproductive skew between certain individual males and the ones that the females find the most attractive.
I mean, what you're saying is that when you don't have to worry about your own survival, then if you're a bird of paradise, you can really focus in on being the sexiest person or the sexiest male on the block.
That's right. I mean, if there's a large cat getting ready to pounce on you, basically natural selection is going to interfere and not let you evolve a yard-long tail.
Right.
And so in New Guinea, this has been attractive to female birds of paradise in the past, and they've chosen males that have certain traits, in this case, say, a really long tail, and it's been able to evolve because there's not some counter-selection force preventing it from happening. So that's definitely one of the important things that has led to the evolution of this extreme stuff in birds of paradise.
Indeed. What are the challenges? I mean, you're the photojournalist here, Tim. What are the challenges of trying to capture the diversity of this bird?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really fascinated about this group of birds is that among these 39 species in this one family, there's just an incredible variety. So, you know, birds of paradise are a family of birds that are all closely related to each other, similar to, you know, the heron family. We've got all these different kinds of egrets and herons and so on, but they all kind of look similar, you know. But in the birds of paradise, there's this incredible variation, and I wanted to capture all that variety, and that means we had to find, like, every different species. Yeah. You know, birds of paradise, they are fairly conspicuous. Many of them are very brightly colored, and they're showy, and they're loud. They call a lot. So when you're out in the rainforest of New Guinea, if you manage to get there, you can see them if you're going bird watching. You know, getting a glimpse of a bird of paradise, you know, feeding in the top of a tree or something like that is you know, doable. It's not that impossible. But on the other hand, I wanted to capture them in the middle of their, you know, courtship behaviors, where the males are displaying to the females and things like that. And that involved a lot of scouting and,
sure,
you know, time in the field, trying to find, you know, where are those display sites that the males are coming to repeatedly, and then basically staking them out. So it involved a lot of, you know, constructing a blind or place to hide and with my camera and wait, whether it's on the ground for the species that are displaying on the ground, as some do, or climbing the trees to get up into the canopy and be at the level where I can photograph the birds at eye level. Make a blind and on a small platform up in a tree, and you know, climb up there in the dark in the morning and hide and wait for the birds to come. So a lot of planning and time went into,
and patience,
you know,
I would think, as well.
Yeah, certainly.
waiting
to try to get, you know, get shots of each species.
You have documented 39 species of birds of paradise, and Edwin, do you think there's a 40th, or do you think you really have found them all?
Well, we didn't discover, we weren't the first discoverers of any of those 39 species. There's been a long history of ornithological exploration in New Guinea and a long historical interest in birds of paradise for museum collections around the world, but also for people who are interested in their extravagant plumes for fashion. So there was a period of time where there were a lot of birds of paradise being exported out of New Guinea to Europe and North America. And so because of that, most of the bird of paradise species have been known of for quite a long time. And so for the most part, there hasn't been a new, very different form of bird of paradise since about the mid-1930s. And all the differences in the number of species that have come about in more recent times have been from sort of minor changes from geographic variation once we get new information from genetics, but also from differences in behavior and voice. So as we learn more about them in the wild, we can make new arguments for different changes to their species status. So in that regard, I think there is likely to be a 40th or a 41st, but it's not going to be a radically new discovery. It's possible. There's still some remote areas in New Guinea, but I don't think likely. But we'll see. Science will do its course, and the science of taxonomy is still thriving, and we'll have some adjustments along the way, undoubtedly.
Well, what's clear, and looking at some of the work that you've done, it's the male birds are extraordinary in their plumage and in their behavior, and the females a little more drab, very typical of nature. But what's clear is that she's deciding which of these guys, as they kind of dance in front of her, which one that she wants to mate with.
That's right. It's really female choice that has driven this kind of evolution by what we call evolution by sexual selection. So the females have, for whatever reason, you know, decided that a particular characteristic of a male, whether it's a, you know, unusual little feathers that are growing out of their side of their head, some kind of long crazy plumes, is particularly, you know, interesting or attractive in a mate, and they've continued to choose maybe the male that had the longest feather of that type, or the most colorful, or the, you know, the most elaborate courtship display, and so that's driven the selection over, you know, many generations of sort of selecting the males with certain characteristics, but also then the offspring of those pairings are also going to be, you know, female offspring are also going to presumably inherit their mother's preferences.
Discerning eye?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could, and there are very few times I feel like, gosh, I wish this were TV, and this,
right,
I think, is actually one of them, talking about birds of paradise. But describe for us, I guess, one of the sort of more exotic, if I can say, mating rituals that you have observed.
Yeah, there's a lot of exotic
several
ones in the birds of paradise. I'm just going to pick one, and I think it's one I can illustrate for radio listeners. So there's a a species called the King of Saxony Bird of Paradise. And the male of this species isn't the most colorful. It isn't one of the largest birds of paradise. If you just saw the male sitting out, for the most part, you would think, oh, it's interesting. It's kind of yellowish underneath, mostly dark. But really what makes this species fantastic is that it's got these two long, almost antenna-like feathers that stick out of its head behind each eye, and they are twice the length of the body of the bird, so they really do look like antennas. And these feathers are unlike any feather that anybody would be familiar with if they hadn't seen a King of Saxony. They don't have the normal feather structure with a branching, delicate feather vein. Here it's all fused together in like plastic-like tabs, and it's only on one side of the central shaft of the feather. And these males, when they go to their courtship display site, which is a vine in the forest understory, they bounce up and down with their legs, and they fluff up some feathers on the back of their neck and body that are really black. It looks like he's wearing a little bit of a cape. And he moves these long antenna-like feathers around and waves them in front of the female while bouncing and making all kinds of funny, chortling, buzzy, whirring, very non-bird-like sounds. And, you know, to put this into perspective, I'd say if this was a human being, if I was standing here with an ornament like this on my head, it would be like me having two 10-foot-long rods coming out of the top of my head that I could wiggle around and move to attract my mate, doing nothing more than using the same kind of muscles that we use to wiggle our eyebrows with, right? These are fine little muscles on the top of a bird's head. It's really fantastic.
And it would be amazing if you could sort of time stop that and see literally how did that evolve? I mean, how did that kind of behavior and also that kind of plumage evolve to what you have observed today?
This is one of the real interesting things with birds of paradise, is that the disparity or the gap between the different major groups of species is so great, it's hard to imagine what was the intermediate in between them. And that's what really makes them an interesting evolutionary, you know, subject for study. And it's this, they're so diverse. They're so unlike one another, at least the males are, from group of species to group of species. But there are sometimes little hints and cues in there. And if you look at what we now know is the group of species that's the next most closest relative to King of Saxony, this is another group of birds of paradise called the Parodia birds of paradise. And what they have are also these little wire-like feathers that come out from behind each eye. Not nearly as long. It's basically just a long central feather with a little racket tip on the end. But you can imagine something like that as the kind of closer to that intermediate form that allowed this really long antenna-like feather in the King of Saxony that females found attractive and selected to become more and more extreme over time.
And Tim, what's so interesting is we're talking about a bird that's not unrelated, or I guess is related in some degree, to the crow.
That's right. You know, birds of paradise are a group of birds that evolved from a crow-like ancestor, you know, maybe going back 20 million years or something around that time frame, you know, in that New Guinea region. They evolved and just radiated into this incredible variety of forms from a bird in the general, you know, in the group that crows are now in. So if you know other sort of bright colored tropical birds that you might see if you went on a trip to Costa Rica or something are not as closely related to birds of paradise as your neighborhood crows, you know, right here in Philadelphia.
Well, it tells you, I guess, about the climate or perhaps even the microclimate in New Guinea that you can create such diversity.
Yes, I mean, as there's several things contributing to that. One of which is this incredible geographic, ruggedness of New Guinea, and the way that the, you know, tectonic plates have been colliding in that region, sort of thrusting up mountains and fracturing off islands. And so there's been a lot of geological activity that has also contributed to, you know, dividing populations of birds into two different mountain ranges that then they have time to evolve differently in these different locations. And so this kind of geological history has also contributed to the speciation of birds of paradise.
Well, we are talking about birds of paradise on Radio Times in this hour of Radio Times. Excuse me, and our guests are Tim Lehman. He's an award-winning wildlife photojournalist and field biologist. Also with us, Edwin Scholes. He's an evolutionary biologist, a curator of video at the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and an exhibit of their work, and Birds of Paradise, is on view at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University in Philadelphia, May 3rd to September 2nd. You can also go to their website, birdsofparadiseproject.org, or go to our website, whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can see what it is that we are talking about. You can also give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, 1812's annual political comedy, This is the Week That Is. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and This is the Week That Is ensemble, this annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on the day's most important news, from Russian invasions to dog curbing in South Philadelphia. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley College. This summer, DelVal is offering a wide selection of accelerated full-term and online degree completion programs. Courses include business administration, biology, chemistry, education, and computer and business information systems. College students can take advantage of these classes and get ahead of their course load in time for the fall semester. Scholarship information and full course catalog at delval.edu/summer. Delaware Valley College. Convenient, accessible, flexible.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Tim Lehman and Edwin Scholes. We are talking about Birds of Paradise. They have spent almost a decade in the rainforests of New Guinea, also along the northeast coast of Australia, documenting the diversity and the extraordinary mating dances of this bird. There are 39 species of this bird, and we are talking about it on Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments about Birds of Paradise? Well, we were talking about the unusual behavior of the King of Saxony Bird of Paradise. Let's hear what it sounds like. So what are we hearing, Edwin?
Well,
how does he make that sound?
Yeah, it doesn't really sound much like most of the birds we're familiar with around here, does it?
It's snapping sounds, it sounds like, almost.
It is, but it's all vocal, so there's no non-vocal sounds there. He's not doing anything with his bill or his wings or anything to make that snapping sound. So, no, it's just basically this almost white noise-like burst of buzzing insect-like sound, and he's just vocalizing, you know, and using his syrinx, opening his mouth, and making those sounds. And that's his kind of long-range advertisement vocalization.
So
he's using that to say, "I'm here." He's saying that to neighboring males. This is my territory. He's trying to attract females to come and watch his courtship display, where he's going to be highlighting those feathers that we were talking about while bouncing around on a vine. When the female's there really close to him, he doesn't quite blast her with that sound. It's pretty loud. So he has a whole bunch of other more subtle, chirpy, quieter sounds that are interesting as well that he makes when she's closer.
Kind of sweet nothings, if we can anthropomorphize.
<That's right>.
Here. I'm curious, Tim, do the males fight each other for a female's affection or attention? Do you see that?
Males are not directly fighting each other, although, you know, some of the species, the individual males have their own courtship display court. They actually clear an area on the ground and prepare a dancing ground for themselves to perform when the females come. And, you know, occasionally another male might come and kind of be watching one male, and he might get chased, you know, be chased away or something like that. You know, males want to have the exclusive attention of the females at these display sites. But yeah, generally, except for, you know, don't take my spot kind of thing, they're not really fighting for the females. They're letting the females do the choosing.
Yeah. So you may hate me for saying this, but as I was watching the Birds of Paradise and even reading about them, I was thinking about the Chippendales. So, you know, these are the kind of male strippers that perform for for women, often before a woman gets married even.
Yeah, yeah. Now that male birds of paradise are really all, you know, their life is pretty much dedicated to one thing. They don't play any role in parental care. So it's all about trying to attract as many females as possible and mate and pass on their genes. And they do that day after day by spending many, many hours a day dancing and showing off. And this is what female birds of paradise have selected for and basically made happen over many, many generations of mate choice. They've basically, one thing I like to say is and think about is basically the way male birds of paradise look and act today is basically the, you know, ghost of many generations of female choice past. Basically, they're carrying along the baggage of all these preferences from females in the past.
And saying, I like you, nah, I don't like you so much.
That's right. So, you know, maybe female humans like guys in very small shorts and tight, you know, and bow ties on. I don't know if you can carry it that far, but that's what's going on in Birds of Paradise.
Yeah. You're a tree climber, are you not, Tim?
Yes.
You climb trees.
I do. I do. I've been climbing trees for a long time, apparently since I was a little kid, according to my parents. But no, as a professionally or as a scientist, I began doing a lot of tree climbing in Borneo while I was working on my PhD research in rainforest ecology there. And I wanted to study the life up in the canopy. There's so much going on up in the canopy of the rainforest. And so I started developing techniques and learning techniques for accessing the canopy. And I use a bow and arrow to shoot a fishing line, you know, attached to an arrow up and over a branch high in a tree. And then I pull up a climbing rope, and then I use a harness and ascenders, you know, camming devices to climb a rope. And that's how I get up into the canopy. And so, yeah, during my PhD research, I climbed, you know, many, many trees in Borneo doing this research. And then as I moved on to doing a lot of wildlife photography in rainforests around the world, I found this to be a really useful thing to have in my bag of tricks, is to bring along a duffel bag full of climbing ropes and gear and bows and arrows. And so wherever I go, I can get up to the top of the trees if I need to.
Well, and there's I was watching some National Geographic video about the two of you, and one where you have a camera, and it looks like a gigantic leaf kind of sewed around it to, so that it was disguised, and obviously you didn't have to be there in order to document these birds of paradise.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, one thing I'm always sort of striving to do in my wildlife photography is to try to capture an image from a unique angle, you know, some kind of perspective that maybe people haven't seen before. That's difficult to get. And so I don't always want to be shooting with a big, long telephoto lens from far away, getting a close-up of the bird. I want to get my camera, like, close to the birds and sort of show them in context of their environment if I can. And so, yeah, I developed techniques of sort of hiding a camera up in the canopy close to the branch where I thought the bird was going to come back to, and then controlling that camera remotely, you know, by a cable connected to a laptop. And in that case, you know, it wasn't really possible to run the cable all the way down to the ground, and it was a bit too far away, so I had to control it from another tree. So I had one platform, one tree, I had my blind where I could hide and observe what was going on from the adjacent tree, and then I had a cable running over to the tree where the birds were, where I had a small camera hidden among leaves, and I was able to, you know, take my laptop up into my blind in the canopy and control my camera remotely and get some unique shots that way.
In fact, one of the extraordinarily unique shots is looking at one of these dances and trying to figure out, so what is she looking at? You know, it's like front on, it looks one way, but looking down, if she's on a perch looking down at a bird of paradise doing his thing, it's a very different experience.
Yeah, I think you're referring to one of the Parodia birds of paradise, where the male is dancing on the ground and has this fans out this skirt-like spread of feathers. And we are always filming it from ground level and looking at it from the side, where this bird looks like a ballerina dancer, and this dance is even called the ballerina dance. But we realize that, well, the females are always perching on a horizontal branch above the male, looking straight down. So what does it look like to her? So then we put the effort into rig up a remote control camera on a tree, you know, above the court, like looking down on it, to get that female perspective. And that turned out to be really interesting.
What does she see?
It's interesting, just to follow up on that, it's interesting both from a scientific perspective as well as what Tim was saying, just being able to document and see these birds in a way that they've never been seen before in a cutting-edge way. You know, reaching back to what we were talking about before, I mean, seeing this display from the female's perspective, this is the most important context of all, right? It doesn't matter what it looks like to us as human observers. All of this exists because of what it looks like to the female. So she's evaluating who she wants to mate with based on what it looks like. And if she's above looking down, that's the way we have to study this. And so what we found out is instead of looking like a bird standing on the ground on a little cleared stage, looks like he's wearing a black tutu. From her perspective, it actually looks like this very black. These are velvet black feathers. It looks like a black ovoid or a disc. And it's very graphic. It's very flat. She sees very little dimensionality in it. And none of his color ornaments are showing up as he walks out and positions himself directly underneath her. And then at a specific moment in the display, when he's right beneath her where he needs to be for her to see what he wants to show off to her, he reveals these flashes of intense directional iridescent feathers that are in stark contrast to the whole environment around him and his black costume, if you will. And so this was what was revealed by going through the great effort of putting the camera up in the tree and looking down and seeing what the female sees, something that none of us had ever seen before. I spent my whole PhD dissertation studying this particular group of birds of paradise, and I had no idea that this is exactly what was going on in that moment of the courtship display, where they were revealing these you know, bright, directional, flashy, iridescent, shiny, metallic colors.
So is it the brightest, the biggest, the flashiest? So who wins? I mean, who does she choose?
You know, we don't really know yet, and that's the thing. A lot of birds of paradise, we're just now at the phase of describing what they do for the very first time. And in order to figure out what it is exactly, down to the details, that's making one individual male more attractive than another, we don't know. We would have to go out and measure the differences in these displays in very nuanced ways and measure them and use complicated statistics to determine which are the things that differ among the males who are mating the most. We look at them and we think all of them look pretty darn good.
They're attractive to us.
But yet not all of those males are mating. Usually within any one given population, only one or two males are mating at all, and only one is mating with almost all of the females.
So is that how it works?
Yeah, so there's one male that's definitely way more attractive than all the rest. And figuring out what that is that makes him the super male, that's going to be, you know, a whole nother years of certain kinds of study that we haven't even started yet, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much potential for more research on birds of paradise, but, you know, it's hard enough just to find, you know, one good male display site and, you know, do the kind of research that, you know, Ed just referring to, where you need a good sample size of dozens or, you know, of males and measure how which one was the most attractive to females and so on. You need a whole, like, army of graduate students out there, you know, finding these birds and collecting data. But certainly that there's a lot of interesting aspects to study.
We had an email about invasive species, whether that's an issue in terms of their survivability. What are the threats to birds of paradise, Tim?
Yeah, well, birds of paradise, at this point in time, in terms of threats, I mean, they're in pretty good shape because there's still a lot of rainforest left in the New Guinea region relative to, you know, some other parts of the tropics, especially other parts of Asia. Out of the 39 species, there are only three that are currently listed as endangered species, and those are the ones that have a very small ranges and are losing habitat more quickly than others, perhaps. But there are a lot of threats to birds of paradise that we can see sort of looming on the horizon. You know,
such as
the main thing is habitat loss. You know, their rainforests are under threat from, you know, from logging, from oil palm plantation, from mining and things like that. And there aren't very many protected areas or, you know, national parks or conservation areas in the New Guinea region. We're kind of ahead of the curve in the sense that, you know, they're in pretty good shape right now, but definitely, you know, we're really hoping that, you know, more awareness about birds of paradise can help direct some more attention toward conservation and focus on that in the future so that these birds will be around. As to the specific question about invasive species, you know, there are, of course, many invasive species, especially around villages and towns in New Guinea. But so far in the sort of deeper in the rainforest where most of the birds of paradise live, that isn't a huge problem, I wouldn't say.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Tim Lehman. He's an award-winning wildlife photojournalist, also a field biologist. Also with us, Edwin Scholes. He's an evolutionary biologist, curator of video at the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And an exhibition of their work is on display at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University here in Philadelphia, May 3rd to September 2nd, called Birds of Paradise, Amazing Avian Evolution. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. Any questions or comments, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also go to birdsofparadiseproject.org, and you can find out more about these birds. And we posted some of them on our website at whyy.org/radiotimes. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm curious about whether you've seen in the years that you've been doing this, the impacts of climate change. Are those impacts in any way obvious, visible?
You know, that's a difficult thing, I think, with the reality of climate change all around the world is, you know, it's never quite visible enough to, you know, see it and see what's going on. It takes a long time, lots of study to notice how things are changing in response to climate change. And so I can't say that I've, you know, in my short time in a geological sense or in a climatic sense, have seen something that I could say is a visible impact of climate change on birds of paradise. However, New Guinea is a very montane, very mountainous place, and it's all within the tropics, and it's an island. And birds of paradise are sedentary forest birds. Most of them live in the mountains, and they don't disperse long distance. They don't migrate. So as climate changes and forests start moving further up, slowly up the mountains, there's nowhere for any of those species that can't migrate out of there to go other than up. And because birds of paradise live in some of the highest forest elevations, you know, places where even now it's, you know, cool mornings, you can find snow up on tops above tree line, even on the equator there. The birds of paradise that live that high up, they're going to run out of habitat fast. And so there's been a few studies. A graduate student at the University of Kansas, who's actually a Papua New Guinean student, he did some ecological modeling based on distributions of birds of paradise and looked at some of these climate models projecting where forests go in the future. And some of these highest elevation birds of paradise are some of the most vulnerable because they're going to run out of habitat first, so they're most likely to go extinct. So we aren't seeing it, but it's happening, and that's definitely a threat to birds of paradise. That's imminent and, you know, long-term.
Worrisome for as well. How did you, Tim, become interested in birds of paradise? I know you grew up in Japan. Is that right? Your parents were missionaries?
That's right, yeah. I grew up in Japan. I kind of developed an early, you know, interest in outdoors and nature when I was a kid in Japan. And I studied biology all through school. So I think my first kind of inkling and really, you know, awareness about birds of paradise came, I'm sure I heard about them sometime during my earlier studies, but when I read the classic kind of natural history account of Alfred Russel Wallace's travels called the Malay Archipelago. He was this British naturalist and collector of natural history specimens who in the 1850s spent, you know, 8 years in the Indonesian archipelago traveling around. And you know, in the Malay Archipelago, he describes his quest to go and be the first sort of European naturalist to see birds of paradise displaying. You know, by that point, many birds of paradise specimens had reached Europe, but nobody really knew what they did with all these feathers. And, you know, he described these amazing, you know, displays of these beautiful male greater birds of paradise with their golden plumes, like up on the top of the trees in the sunrise. And you know, I at that time was going to go to Indonesia and work in Borneo, and I ended up spending, you know, many years working in Borneo, where there are no birds of paradise, but there are, you know, orangutans and hornbills and other interesting wildlife. But ever since I'd read that book, I wanted to go to, you know, eastern Indonesia, to the region near New Guinea where birds of paradise are found. So that's kind of piqued my interest, and then eventually I got over there on a bird watching trip and saw a few species. But it still took me many years before I became a regular contributor to National Geographic magazine. I was working for them, doing you know, all kinds of different wildlife-related stories. And I finally, in the early 2003 or so, I pitched this idea of doing an article on birds of paradise with photography, because the previous one that they had done was way back in the 50s. They had done a story in National Geographic using paintings on birds of paradise. So it was kind of overdue to really feature this spectacular group of birds. And so that got approved, and I started doing my research on who I could team up with, and that's when I learned about Ed's research in New Guinea on birds of paradise and teamed up with him.
Well, we're going to take another short break, and we'll find out about your interest, Edwin Scholes. We are talking about birds of paradise. And again, our guests are Edwin Scholes and Tim Lehman. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We also have some more sounds of birds of paradise as well. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
Supporting WHYY, Opera Philadelphia presents Don Giovanni, Mozart's classic opera about the legendary Don Juan. A blend of comedy and tragedy, this mischievous tale of mistaken identity reveals Don Giovanni's darkest side. Alumni of the Curtis Institute of Music and the Academy of Vocal Arts star in a lavish production. Don Giovanni at the Academy of Music from April 25th through May 4th. Tickets and information at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Edwin Scholes and Tim Lehman. They've witnessed the elaborate and unusually choreographed mating dances of birds of paradise, which truly defy description. The moves, the calls, the plumage show how creative and, frankly, how outlandish evolution can be. Scholes and Lehman have documented their adventures and discoveries in videos and in a book. And a new exhibit of their work opens this weekend at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University here in Philadelphia, Birds of Paradise, Amazing Avian Evolution. Edwin Scholes is an evolutionary biologist, Tim Lehman, a wildlife photojournalist, and that's what we're talking about on Radio Times. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious, Edwin, how you got into Birds of Paradise, and sounds like we could thank David Attenborough and I guess one of those PBS specials.
Yeah, I was still an undergraduate studying at the University of Arizona, and I was interested in evolutionary biology and ornithology, and I had actually spent a little time already studying sexual selection, taking some time off from school in Australia on a similar kind of mating system in another group of birds. And yeah, I happened to catch the premiere of a program called Attenborough in Paradise, which was a BBC production. It was sort of a realization of a lifelong dream and ambition of Sir David Attenborough to film and document and share Birds of Paradise beyond just a couple of species. And that was sort of the first treatment of the group that was, broadcast around the world. And I saw that, and I remember sitting there just feeling like I was just inches from the television screen thinking, if I could just do anything in my life, I just want to see a bird of paradise someday. And so the rest is history, I guess.
Indeed it is. I do want to play another clip that you brought of a bird of paradise. This is the curl-crested manakote. Let's listen, and then we can talk a bit about it. Describe that. How do you describe that, Tim?
It's like a...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's like a Jetson's ray gun or something, right? I think that's what I always think of.
Yeah, that's better than what I could have come up with. But how unusual is that?
Yeah, it's, I mean, what an orchestra of sound.
This bird actually has a very interesting, mechanism for making that sound. It has a really elongated trachea that loops around underneath its skin on its chest and is this big, long kind of, sounding chamber for making that incredible sound.
Let me see what Eric from Quakertown has to say. And Eric, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm really curious about just the specifics of this area, Papua New Guinea, Northern Australia. I've kept freshwater fish from all over the world, and quite a few of them have crazy mating dances. But I just recently got some turquoise rainbow fish from Papua New Guinea, Lake Kutubu, I believe, and they do the exact same thing that you're talking about with the birds. The male gets under the female. You can only observe this from above. The male's under the female, very drab in color, nothing special going on. All of a sudden, this neon flasher appears on the male's forehead, and he flashes this kind of orange-yellow pulse at the female and does it in rhythm. And, they kind of do their little shimmy dance and release the eggs, and, that's the story. But I've never witnessed this before. I've kept fish for years. Suddenly, the fish from this particular area seem to have this very bizarre, color-pulsing dance, which sounds a lot like what you're describing. And I'm just curious if this is something that is specific to that geographic area, that all the species engage in something, really interesting.
Eric, it's a great question.
Yeah, it is a good question.
Go ahead, Damon.
You wouldn't have to look far to also ask the same question with the people. If you look at the cultural traditions of the people around New Guinea, especially in the highlands, you'll find, whole societies that have these really elaborate, colorful dances. They wear birds of paradise feathers and traditional headdresses, and they're all different from one place to the next. Usually it's the men showing off and dancing, presumably also for females. Not always. Some societies have women doing it. So, yeah, at first glance, it might be what's going on in this part of the world. Rainbow fish are even more diverse than birds of paradise. Every different river system and tributary all throughout New Guinea has its own unique and diverse different types of rainbow fish. It's not just this one. And most of them are colorful and elaborate, and we don't know much about their behavior for most of them. So I don't know, really, other than it being a very biodiverse, rich region, and it being very geographically complex, so it really lends itself to isolation in populations, and whether it's culturally and humans, and they're not intermixing much, and they develop their own traditions of song and dance and show, or in the courtship display behaviors of birds like birds of paradise or fish like the rainbow fish. But, you look at all the rest of the biodiversity around there, it's not like everything's that way.
Right.
The marsupial mammals are like mammals everywhere. For the most part, they're, very brown and cryptic and hidden. We don't see this going on in the other mammals. Certainly there are other birds that do this in New Guinea as well, but for the most part, most don't.
Anything you want to add to that, Tim?
Well, just that this phenomenon of sexual selection, this sort of, the ornamented males doing displays for females. Yeah, I mean, birds of paradise are kind of like the ultimate culmination of that in the bird world. But there are other examples that people are familiar with, like, the peacock's tail would be, another classic example. Or, there are many other examples of, grouse dancing out on the American plains, or where the males are putting on performances for females. So this phenomenon does occur throughout the biological world in other species as well. But birds of paradise is just like an especially unique and diverse example of it.
Eric, thanks for the call. You can call us as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I do want to play another clip, and this is the Goldie's Bird of Paradise. And let's play the second clip that we have set up, and then we can talk a bit about that. And again, this is another example of the diversity of Bird of Paradise. Is that one bird? Two birds?
That's actually two birds.
That's two
what
birds.
You're hearing there is a duet. They're very, very synchronized duet. So this is one of the kind of classic plumed birds of paradise where the males are displaying what we call a lek, or a gathering place where two or more males display together. And so these are two males that are kind of cooperating in their display and also in their calling to attract females. And, yeah, at the exhibit at the Academy of Natural Sciences that's going to open on Saturday, you know, you can hear a lot of these calls. There are all kinds of interesting ways to get in to see the material that we're talking about here. You can even, besides watching the videos and seeing specimens of the birds, you can also even try out your hand at pretending to be a Parodia, Bird of Paradise, and in an interactive kind of dance game that some of our exhibit developers have helped to create. So, yeah, there's some pretty fun ways to learn about Birds of Paradise there.
Let me see what looks like Bonnie from Princeton has to say. Bonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I saw the wonderful Smithsonian film on television. It was so exciting. Those birds are marvelous. I'd like to know if how did birds' vocalization evolve, and do any lizards or anything like that vocalize?
Well, let me. Do we know how those vocalizations
have
evolved?
The closest living relative to birds are alligators. And alligators, even though it's not widely known, they do vocalize. They bellow, and I'm sure it's not a surprise to people living in Florida or in the South. They bellow and do things. So they vocally communicate. Young alligators chirp to get out of their eggs, make sounds. And certainly we know that the group of dinosaurs for which birds are their modern relatives of, they almost certainly had various forms of vocal communication. And it's hard to study those parts of the anatomy from fossils alone, but there are things that give us clues to that along the way. So basically, asking how bird song evolved, it's kind of like you can't even start there. It started way before birds.
Indeed. But it sounds like it's pretty noisy, or can get really noisy when you're out in the field. Tim?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of the main ways that we find and locate the Birds of Paradise. Is the males are very vocal, and they're using sound to tell the females where they are, because you can't see that far through the rainforest, and so sound is really important for not only the Birds of Paradise but many other species as well. So there's often a really spectacular sort of dawn chorus in the morning as we're out there wating for everything to come to life and start calling in the morning.
Those last two species that we heard, the curl-crested manakote and the Goldie's Bird of Paradise, interestingly enough, those are both island endemics on just a handful of very small islands just off the eastern end of New Guinea. And that's the only place in the whole world where those two species are found. That might be – it's a very acoustically rich environment, as you can imagine, with those two sounds being some of the most prominent sounds in the forest there. But, the dawn chorus there is incredible for a variety of other species as well, but including those two. It's definitely a place made for radio.
we're all about that. And that's Edwin Scholes joining us along with Tim Lehman. We are talking about Birds of Paradise, an exhibit of their work and some of the field work that they've been doing, including photographs on view at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University in Philadelphia, May 3rd to September 2nd. You can also go to birdsofparadiseproject.org, and you can go to our webpage, whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can see what we have been talking about. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm curious about when, and perhaps I'll toss this to you first, Edwin, which is when you're out in the field. I'm assuming you're in tent somewhere and just sort of living close by to the places where you are doing your observing.
Yeah, for most of the expeditions, we're getting into places that are very remote. We want to get away from certainly all the towns and cities and even away from the villages, just because even a village that has no electricity is still a noisy place. There are the occasional rooster. There are people chopping down trees for firewood, and people doing the we call it the bush telephone form of communication, where you yell loudly across from one side of the valley to the other. So we usually get to really remote places where the forest is really good and there's no sounds that are going to disrupt our work. And that means usually camping in a you know, kind of a primitive camp setting. In New Guinea, we usually make a frame, put a big tarp because it rains a lot, and then we have a larger area that we can keep dry, where we will then sometimes put tents and maintain a fire under there and have all of our gear trying to stay dry. That's always a real important thing in the rainforests of New Guinea.
Yeah, and I would think keeping cameras dry. Yeah, challenge?
It's always a challenge to keep all the camera gear working.
And is there a lot of camera gear?
There is. There's a fair bit required. I mean, you know, we're working in such remote areas that you can't just go out there with one camera. So you need to have some backups in a wide variety of large lenses to photograph the birds with. So, we often, you know, kind of looks like sometimes like one of these old-fashioned expeditions when we maybe fly in by bush plane to a small airstrip in the remote mountains of New Guinea somewhere where there's a little village. And then we unload all of our gear and we kind of lay it out there and we have a negotiation session with some villagers and end up hiring, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 people, including, you know, 2 weeks worth of food for us and a small crew of maybe 3 or 4 local guys that are going to help us out in the field. So, and then we maybe hike for several hours up into the mountains and set up a campsite with this whole train of, you know, porters going up there. So, it's really exciting and wonderful to spend time in those kind of places. We really enjoy it just for the experience of experience, you know, being in these sort of wild places. As well as, of course, getting to see some of these birds of paradise.
Indeed. I was reading that at one of your trips there, you got appendicitis.
Yeah.
That must have been a little scary.
That. I mean, for the most part, we've been pretty fortunate with our, medical issues, and we've stayed healthy, and most things have been pretty minor. That's probably the most major thing that's happened to either of us there and to me. And, I was fortunate because I'm still here. I got out.
Indeed, you were.
Was in a really remote area and just happened to take the right combination of things to stabilize myself long enough to be able to get on a helicopter and get out of there. But it was not recommended by any doctor. It was about 5 days between when I first had the symptoms of my appendicitis and when I actually had my appendectomy, which is pretty rare to go that long.
I was going to say, that's a long time. Yeah. And I'm sure the pain was probably pretty excruciating.
It was very uncomfortable, but I still had to hike up the mountain to get to the place where the helicopter could pick me up, and there really wasn't a place to land a helicopter, so I had to climb onto the skids of the helicopter and try to crawl into a hovering helicopter. So it was. It's an interesting, very long story. Unfortunately, longer than we have here.
But you made it. Yes, an interesting story. Is it hard to re-enter or come back to the United States for you, Tim? I mean, going to such a remote and different part of the world.
No, I think I'm pretty used to making the switch. You know, I could go on an expedition for a month or 6 weeks to a place like New Guinea, and when I head back on the planes back across the Pacific or whatever, you know, I'm ready to spend some time at home. And so now I've been doing this for so many years that sort of switching back and forth is not a big deal for me now.
And I know you're itching to go to Borneo. You're working on an orangutan.
Yes,
project.
Another project that I'm working on with National Geographic right now is to document the sort of culture of orangutans, the diversity of orangutans across their range in Sumatra and Borneo. So I'm actually heading back in about 10 days to Indonesia to go to several orangutan research sites, including my wife Cheryl Knott's site in Gunung Palung National Park, where she's been studying orangutans for many years. So,
well, it's been such a pleasure to have you both on Radio Time to talk about birds of paradise and to see your work as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Tim Lehman, an award-winning wildlife photojournalist and field biologist. Edwin Scholes, an evolutionary biologist, also curator of video at the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can see some photos of birds of paradise taken by our guest Tim Lehman. Also check out birdsofparadiseproject.org. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.